Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. In a few moments I'll be sharing with you the witness of an abbot who travelled to the Holy Land to comment for German TV on Pope Benedict XVI's first journey to this part of the world. And stepping back in time to that of a journalist who witnessed that first historic visit to the Holy Land by a Roman pontiff. He was Paul VI. But first of all, let's take a look at the latest news from the Vatican, where on Friday, Benedict XVI received in audience a number of new ambassadors to the Holy See, who were there to present their letters of credence. Among them, in particular, the ambassador of New Zealand to the Holy See, Robert Carey Moore Jones, whom the Pope welcomed to the Vatican, expressing the hope that his appointment would serve to strengthen the existing bonds of friendship between the two states. On this occasion, the Pope highlighted how he'd recently had the opportunity of experiencing something of the spirit of New Zealand when he'd met with the youth from this nation during the recent July World Youth Day in Sydney. A spirit of enthusiasm he hoped new generations would channel into forging friendships across divides and creating places of living faith in and for our world, settings of hope and charity. The Holy Father then focused precisely on the positive aspect of this cultural diversity of New Zealand, stressing how it brings richness to the social fabric of the nation, how the growing presence of migrant communities from various religious traditions, together with the government's increasing participation in Pacific and Asian affairs, raises the awareness of the fruits that can be obtained through interreligious dialogue. Benedict XVI then went on to praise New Zealand's generous commitment to peacekeeping initiatives across the world and express his awareness of its diplomatic activity, predominant in the Pacific and considerable in Asia, marked, he said, by a strong commitment to justice and peace, good governance, sustainable economic development, and promotion of human rights. The Pope also spoke of his confidence in the Catholic Church's mission of service within this nation, in particular her commitment in the spiritual and intellectual formation of the young, her work with those on the margins of society. Finally, he expressed his spiritual closeness to the families in New Zealand, which, like so many across the globe, are suffering from the effects of the current economic crisis. The Ambassador of New Zealand, Robert Carey Moore Jones, was kind enough to come into our studios here earlier in the week to be interviewed by Philippa Hitchin. Let's listen.
You've worked mainly in the Asia and the Pacific regions up to now before coming here. What are you hoping perhaps to bring to this new job here in Europe, particularly in this relationship between New Zealand and the Holy See?
We work together in a variety of different ways. We've worked together in, for example, cluster munitions, the work on the convention there. We've worked together in areas like interfaith dialogue. We both have a strong shared concern about human welfare development issues. So I think the question is to enhance the dialogue, enhance mutual understanding, and look for other areas where we can work together. And a particular focus on that would be the Pacific. The Pacific is a region undergoing fundamental change, and a lot of it is for the worse. Across the Pacific region, you have poor governance, very weak institutions. You have growing populations where social services are under considerable stress. In places like Fiji, you've had yet another military coup. So it's a key focus of New Zealand's foreign policy. And the church has got quite a prominent role and profile in most Pacific Island societies. So I think there are opportunities to share knowledge, to share insights, and possibly also look at where there are collaborative ways we can help in terms of the development agenda. And you've mentioned environment. Well, of course, underpinning all of those other challenges, we now have the challenge of climate change.
Absolutely. We think of that region as an area of beautiful landscapes, paradise islands and so on. But of course, this is a real threat, isn't it? How much is this a priority for your government, tackling these problems?
Well, the environmental agenda is a key priority for the government. It has a number of levels. On the one hand, many of the Pacific Island countries are low-lying atolls, so their very future is at risk from rising sea levels. But there are other steps along the way. I mean, one of the things that is of concern is that with climate change, with global warming, you tend to have more frequent, more severe weather incidents. So more cyclones, typhoons. And they, in big countries, a typhoon can cause a lot of damage. But in small, vulnerable societies, they can actually wipe out the national economy. So they have much more devastating impacts in those fragile states. And if you look at some of them, Tuvalu is several thousand people on an island that is gravely at risk of global warming. So it's a big challenge, very large challenge.
Many of these areas, of course, populated by people who've been there for many, many thousands of years, long before the white settlers came. Your own country, New Zealand, of course, the Maori issue is of great concern for the church, isn't it? Now, together with the United States and Canada, I think I'm right in saying that New Zealand voted against the adoption of the UN General Assembly's Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People. Why was that, first of all?
I think there were fundamental issues about some of the language used in the declaration. There was a concern that for many countries, adopting the declaration had no particular domestic ramifications, and that we need to deal with the issues of race relations in New Zealand in our way, and I think we are doing that. You said that the Maori population is of great concern to the church. Well, I hope that that's also been seen as a positive process. We have a long-standing treaty settlement process, which is about settling historical grievances over land. We have an ongoing process of political dialogue in New Zealand every day between the peoples of New Zealand. I mean, fundamentally, yes, that's the European and Maori population, but we also have an Asian population, which is now in Auckland, for example, probably 12% of the population is of Asian origin. So New Zealand is quite a multicultural country and proud of it, and proud of the way that we are seeking to ensure that it's an inclusive and generous society to everybody, while recognising what we call the particular position of the tangata whenua, the people of the land, the Maori people.
So is there any intention to review this document? I know Australia has since reviewed and adopted. Is there any interest?
I think there is an ongoing process of looking at the declaration that has been a renewed interest recently, as Australia has said that he will look at it. I can't say where that process will go, but certainly that review is underway at the moment.
You mentioned the other more recent immigrants, new arrivals in New Zealand. And again, Caritas, the church as a whole, has been raising its concerns about these people, about the domestic human rights policy of your country. What's your response to that?
Well, I would be very surprised if there are domestic human rights issues involving the new populations in New Zealand. I think New Zealand would stack up extremely well against any country in the world in terms of the way in which new peoples are integrated into the system. I mean, for example, in New Zealand, if you're a resident or who's lived there for more than 12 months, you automatically have the right to vote. I think if you look at Asian representation in the New Zealand Parliament, it's good and it's growing. We have currently one Chinese New Zealand cabinet minister. I think there are not, as far as I know, concerns over human rights for Asian peoples in New Zealand.
I was simply looking at a quote from the director of Caritas, Michael Smith, saying the country is justifiably proud of the role it has often played internationally as a human rights champion, just as you're saying, but it cannot afford to be complacent about these questions at home.
I wouldn't take that as a criticism, and I think he's perfectly correct that we shouldn't be complacent. But I don't think we are. I think there is a constant and ongoing and very creative debate in New Zealand about what it means to be a multicultural society. How do we become one nation, but recognising the strength that we draw from our diversity? I think it's a very healthy discussion and debate we have all the time. And these are issues which all New Zealanders are very aware of, because it is very transparent sort of discussion that takes place.
Perhaps some lessons for us here in Europe as well.
Well, I think all of us need to deal with our own issues in our own ways, but certainly the open dialogue we have in New Zealand is something that I believe is very, very positive for us.
Just looking at your past experience, I was wondering your experience as a diplomat in Asia, working a little bit on the Korean issue as well. We're very concerned, of course, at the moment about the current flare-up of tensions, and I'm wondering whether you can share with us at all any insights about the workings, particularly of that Asian region, in trying to overcome this.
Well, I think the New Zealand government has expressed its own strong concern over the latest, the nuclear test and the missile tests, as we have done previously. New Zealand has worked behind the scenes to do what it can to support the six-party peace process, which has been going on for 4 or 5 years now. And in fact, I was fortunate enough 2 years ago to go with the New Zealand Foreign Minister to Pyongyang to deliver a message that New Zealand went non-nuclear in 1986. We've had very strong credentials in terms of the disarmament agenda, disarmament process. We believe very strongly in a denuclearised Korean Peninsula. We have the cemeteries of New Zealand servicemen who died there in the Korean War. So that's been a very long-standing interest of ours, both in terms of nuclear disarmament and in terms of peace and security in a part of the world that's very important to New Zealand.
Can you tell us anything about the kind of reception that you had there in Pyongyang?
Well, that when the New Zealand minister went there, he was the first minister from a Western country who had visited for quite some time. And I think they were good, generous hosts. We had some good, vigorous discussions. And we would like to think that we made a difference. But the latest test suggests that it's going to take a long time.
You were listening there to the Ambassador of New Zealand to the Holy See, Robert Carey Moore-Jones, speaking to Philippa Hitchin. And now moving on in the broadcast, I'd like to join the Abbot Primate of the Benedictine Confederation, Notke Wolf, who recently returned from the Holy Land, where he travelled at the request of the German media, who asked him to comment on Pope Benedict's words there during his apostolic visit from the 8th to the 15th of May.
I was there with the German television to comment on his sermons or his talks, what he said. And it was very amazing to me. He was always seen as a man who would be, people said, against interreligious dialogue. But he showed an interreligious dialogue, how he sees it. It's not the common denominator of several ways of thinking of several religions, but he wants that they collaborate for the sake of the human being, for the freedom, for human values, for human rights. Therefore, he says we can collaborate in a number of things with the Muslims, for example, but we have to respect each other. We are different, but nevertheless, we can work together for justice and peace.
Muslims and Christians, precisely because of the burden of our common history, so often marked by misunderstanding, must today strive to be known and recognized as worshippers of God, faithful to prayer, eager to uphold and live by the Almighty decrees, merciful and compassionate, consistent in bearing witness to all that is true and good, and ever mindful of the common origin and dignity of all human persons who remain at the apex of God's creative design for the world and for history.
And the same he tried to do in Israel, but also to insist very much you have to accept also the other ones. There he was rather cautious with the Israelis, I would say, with the Jews. And for example, what was interesting in his talk at Yad Vashem, people criticized that he didn't say, I'm a German and I have all the guilt. He didn't say that I'm guilty and as a German and we are carrying on the guilt. But he had a message of hope. Let's look to the future. Let's never forget the many people who have been killed, who have been murdered.
I have come to stand in silence before this monument, erected to honor the memory of the millions of Jews killed in the horrific tragedy of the Shoah. They lost their lives, but they will never lose their names. They are indelibly etched in the hearts of their loved ones, their surviving fellow prisoners, and all souls determined never to allow such an atrocity to disgrace mankind again. Most of all, their names are forever fixed in the memory of Almighty God.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I heard that at the Yad Vashem memorial, Benedict XVI's use of language was criticized once again by some, of course. Is that so?
Because he didn't say they were murdered, he said they were killed. There was a big storm about that, which I never can understand, I must say. They have been killed. But he says they have their value because they are called by God. By their name, they are called by God. And he said in the end of his talk, let's hope, let's learn from the past so that we never do this again. So he was looking towards the future. And I must say, he tried wherever he went to create hope, to create unity, to create collaboration, to solicit people, to forgive each other. He was working for reconciliation. These are the main words or issues, I would say, and I was very much impressed by his trip there.
He was walking in a minefield, wasn't he?
Of course. That was very difficult. And people were telling he should have said this and that. I said the next time you should write the talks of the Pope. But I think it's the Pope himself who has to do his talks. And in the end you could see very clearly that it was not just coming out in a spontaneous way. But everything was planned to say this here, the other one there. He mentioned the Shoah still in the airport before he left.
One of the most solemn moments of my stay in Israel, my visit to the Holocaust Memorial at Yad Vashem, to pay my respects to the victims of the Shoah. There also I met some of the survivors. Those deeply moving encounters brought back memories of my visit 3 years ago to the death camp at Auschwitz, where so many Jews, mothers, fathers, husbands, wives, sons, daughters, brothers, sisters, friends, were brutally exterminated under a godless regime that propagated an ideology of anti-Semitism and hatred. That appalling chapter of history must never be forgotten or denied. On the contrary, those dark memories should strengthen our determination to draw closer to one another as branches of the same olive tree, nourished from the same roots and united in brotherly love.
So everything was balanced when he was talking, and of course in Israel he felt that he was observed if he says a wrong word and so on. He was far more spontaneous with the Palestinians. And there he could see also the joy of the people, of the Christians there. It's a different situation. But he responded very much to their situation also, to encourage them and to insist that they also have a right to live in their own home country and to have a country which is their own state. Although he never mentioned two states, but he said they have also the right to live in a country, in their own country.
Also, walls can easily be built. We all know that they do not last forever. They can be taken down first, so it is necessary to remove the walls that we build around our hearts, the barriers that we set up against our neighbors. By my parting words, I want to make a renewed plea for openness and generosity of spirit, for an end to intolerance and exclusion. No matter how intricate and deeply entrenched a conflict may appear to be, there are always grounds to hope that it can be resolved, that the patient, persevering efforts of those who work for peace and reconciliation will bear fruit in the end. My earnest wish for you, the people of Palestine, is that this will happen soon and that you will at last be able to enjoy the peace, freedom, and stability that have eluded you for so long.
Are you familiar with the Holy Land?
I have been there several times because we have an abbey, the Domitian Abbey in Jerusalem. Unfortunately, the Pope didn't go there, although he was so close. He was going to the room of the Last Supper, which is just next door to the Benedictines. But we were not even allowed to watch the Pope from the top or from below because of security. I had a talk with Israeli security man. He came to explain things. He talked only Spanish as his second language. So I was talking with him, and he told me that this is the command or the mandate by the Vatican and so on. He cannot do anything and so on. But nevertheless, we have the Benedictines there. We have also a theological school there for German-speaking theologians. They are doing a study here in the Holy Land, which is linked to St. Anselmo. It's dependent upon St. Anselmo and upon our theological faculty. And then they try to build up an academy of peace for the future. We are still looking. We have a foundation for that. We are still looking for money, because it will cost quite something, but we have planned it, how this will go in the future, what will be the way of doing it, of handling it, what kind of courses, what kind of meetings. We have a very interesting experience at Lake Genezareth, at the place of the multiplication of the loaves, of the bread. There we have a small monastery. It's dependent upon Domitian Abbey in Jerusalem. And there they are taking care of the pilgrims, but also in summertime they have a youth camp, and a youth camp for handicapped people, young people. And without any difference, Palestinians, Israelis, so Jewish people get to know Palestinians there, and also in the end the parents of both sides are sitting together, sharing their experiences, shedding tears together. This is something so great, where you can see peace has to grow from the grassroots. You cannot do it just that. Of course, politicians have their own job, they have to do it on top, but people have to grow together, and this can be done only at the grassroots. And that's, for me, a sign of hope.
Bad news travels faster than good news anyway, no?
Yeah. There are the bad and the good are that, like in the gospel, you have the wheat and the weeds growing together.
And our thanks there go to the Abbot Primate of the Benedictine Confederation, Notke Wolf, for sharing with us his thoughts. Meanwhile, why not turn to a journalist who witnessed the very first visit of a Roman pontiff to the Holy Land. His name is Bob Miller, and he reported for ABC at the time. In a few moments, you can hear some excerpts from an archive interview by my colleague Jill Bevilacqua. Comments I put together in this short feature, which begins with the voice of Pope Paul VI. It's the beginning of 1964. Watch the change of pace.
Today, we recall with joy and satisfaction our visit to the Holy Land, a place made sacred by the many events of our lost life.
The term pilgrim pope was first used to describe Paul VI. It was he who decided the time had come to bring the papacy to the people. Convinced that all roads no longer led to Rome, he was the first pope ever to board an aeroplane. Less than a year into his pontificate, Paul VI became the first pope to return to the Holy Land after St. Peter himself.
Impressed upon us our pilgrimage to the place of Christ's glorious triumph could have great historical significance and in God's providence can be far-reaching and beneficial for the Church and for humanity.
The closest I got to him was at the River Jordan when he walked down the stone steps that they had arranged there at the spot where tradition says John the Baptist baptized Jesus.
And it was American journalist Bob Miller was among those reporting on this historic pilgrimage. He recalled the emotion of seeing Paul VI on the banks of the River Jordan.
Some photographer snapped a picture of the Pope, and I'm kind of at the side there. So I was able to watch him. He didn't speak. He merely gazed at the waters and then very slowly turned and walked up the steps and continued the journey.
Our visit is a spiritual one, a humble pilgrimage to the sacred places made holy by the birth, the life, the passion, and death of Jesus Christ, and by his glorious resurrection and ascension.
I hope you enjoyed stepping back in time for a moment, and that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for listening. Should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Bye for now, and don't forget, we'll be back again at the same time tomorrow, so do join us then.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.